Hey, I'm Dave from Boy Azuga.
We got your Cardiff. We got your side project that became a band. We got lots of spare time. We got School of Rock at age 12. We've got your parents from the BBC Orchestra in Wales. Is there something even early on that you can't believe people haven't asked you yet?
I think sometimes people don't ask as much about the actual making of the album as much as I would like. Although I don't really mind.
That's crazy.
But I think that
wouldn't that be the first thing they'd ask about?
Yeah. And I think it's, so people ask about it, but I don't think, like, as someone who reads quite a lot of band and artist interviews and stuff, it's really nice to know about equipment and the process, but that stuff's not as sexy.
You play everything on the record. Is it a band? Is it a project? Or is it a burrito? What is it going to be moving forward?
All three.
Oh, good. What kind of burrito?
It's going to be a spicy vegetarian burrito so everyone can eat it.
You know, there's so many garage projects, but this has been a thing for a long time. And I think this, getting into the making of things, this wasn't like, oh, I'm going to make this and crank it out. This was a long process and a lot of thinking, right?
Definitely, yeah. It was kind of and it's true what you were saying about the kind of garage, homemade thing, because even though it was very, had a homemade aspect to it, because I demoed most of the stuff on GarageBand in my kitchen and bedroom. But then I would go up to Eddie's house. It was kind of like Eddie Alshikachi, he's a complete genius, and he produced, mixed, engineered the album. And he has a studio in his house, but it's not
it's a nice living room. It's not just any house, it's a farm.
It's he lives on a farm, and it's not just that he's got a laptop, he's got a supercomputer, and he's got all these compressors, and he's got amazing mics and synthesizers. So it's not just making a record in any old bedroom. But yeah, I saw this documentary about Caribou when he was making Andorra, and he was living in a flat in London, and the documentary is him and his, basically in a tiny bedroom, and he's making this music that sounds like it comes from outer space. And I was like, that's really cool. I'd love to make something in one room that sounds like it's maybe not from one room.
You were on so many other projects, and even your mates, there have been so many other bands. So where, I usually ask this later on, but how did you know that this particular project you were working on was going to turn into this? Was there a moment that the little light bulb went off and you said, wait a minute, this is not something with someone else. This is mine and mine alone, and this is going to be Boy Azuga.
I'm not sure if there was one particular moment, but it was more just that I just kind of realized I wanted to just spend more time on it, and I really loved doing it. I loved recording with Ed. And then when we sort of finished making the album, I realized I think it would be really fun to do it live. So it kind of just became more of a thing of because I was playing with so many bands that I loved. I really love the bands I play with, but it was I don't really have as much time to do this Boy Azuga thing as I would like. So it kind of, to be fair, a couple of the bands, they kind of start playing as well, but it was just, it kind of happened.
The stars aligned.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was just kind of everything. It kind of became, the opportunity was open to just give it a go now. And then,
so you make this thing. When did you know it was finished and it was a thing? Because there's a lot on here. This is very, you made an album. You know, you didn't make a series of singles. You made this contextual thing that falls together in the quirkiest and most interesting of ways. It's not typical. When did you know that you had something, that you actually had this thing, that then labels could come snooping around, or you could go after that dream label, which we'll talk about in a second?
I think it was just when we started recording, I had a couple songs that I was happy with, and it was going up to Ed's. It was very different to how I'd been recording and writing songs, because I'd just kind of been in my room on GarageBand. But now I had this person I could go to, and he had all of these sort of options. And so we just started experimenting, and Eddie's amazing, because he's got a really sort of he's a doctor in sound design.
So he's got a lot of gear.
He knows his stuff, but he's also really into quite experimental music, and he's into hip hop, he's into Spinal Tap, he's into everything. So he kind of, there's no limits to, like, if you know, you'd say like, oh, I'd love to try this Black Sabbath-y distortion, we're gonna plug it straight into the
and thing. He can pull it up,
and he's just like, let's do it, and he's just like, whatever you want to do, he's up for it, and he kind of wants to serve the song or whatever. So sorry, I went off track there, but basically I think the moment I realized that wanted to make it an album was when I think I had a few more songs, and I had the idea of like, oh, it'd be really cool if the chorus to that song was the intro in a different key to this song here, and then kind of have the whole thing overlap. And on like a load of my favorite records, where whether it's like the Beach Boys or the Avalanches or whoever it is, it's like you'll have these little themes, and like that it kind of like it makes it so much more, for me it kind of makes it more of like a special listen, if it all kind of like, I don't know, you can sort of hear the time that's gone into it. And it's especially like there's some bits on like, I know it's like there's nothing I can add to the conversation about Pet Sounds, but it's like the sort of like
I knew we were gonna go there, by the way. It's right over here. Yeah.
But some of the like on some of the, I think it's in I can't even remember what I was gonna say. In there's like moments on the album where you can hear different melodies from the other songs happening in a really subtle way, but it kind of just adds to the whole like experience of the album, and I was really keen to do that.
So you have the product, you have the thing, and then labels come snooping around, but you had your eyes on only one. I'm doing the announcer voice for fun. And you know, and back to, we've said it off camera, but you know, Gweno. Yeah. But Heavenly meant something to you. So when you had the opportunity to kind of connect with Jeff, yeah, that was like, whoa, wait a minute, this might really happen.
Yeah. It was yeah, it was just like, it was nuts, because I'd heard like quite a lot about Jeff before meeting him, and obviously even just from the sort of quality of the music on the label, and the just Heavenly was just kind of, I remember their venue, The Social in London, I remember going there for a gig with one of my old bands, and they had portraits of King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard up, and there was like H. Hawkline and all these black and white portraits around The Social, and I was like, I would love to be a part of this thing, because it's just like, it was just the coolest, and it was like my heroes and stuff.
You're
so
like, wait a minute, this could happen.
And it was, yeah, it was kind of like I got introduced to Jeff through a lovely musician and really talented. He runs Shape Records with his wife Emma, a guy called Mark Thomas, who lives in Wales. And I was working in the University of South Wales, and he was working there too. And we just happened to meet on a Monday after an Azuga gig we'd put on. And he happened to like the gig, and then he just said, I'll message Jeff for you, because he had introduced H. Hawkline to Heavenly, and then obviously knew Gweno as well. So there was just this lucky little link, basically. And Toby, who was just in here now, we filmed the Loner Boogie video with him, and we had that video ready to go. So sent it to Jeff. And Danny and Jeff, they heard the album, and it kind of went from there. I remember the exact moment I was walking my friend Luke Sweeney's dog in a park in Cardiff called Roth Park, and it was like, I hadn't really heard back from any label stuff, and I was a bit bummed out. And then I got this email from Jeff, and it said, Jeff Heavenly, and it was like, I really like Loner Boogie, I'd love to hear more. And I was like, yes.
Whoa.
And it was like, yeah, kind of, everything kind of went from there.
One day, way back in the day, and I can't remember, I could show you the picture later, this band came across my desk, and they were called The Darkness.
Oh, yeah.
And they came over, and I sat with Justin, and we sat, and he smoked a cigarette on the top of a hotel, you know, and blew the smoke in my face.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I don't give a if anybody thinks we're Queen.
Yeah, yeah.
But everything comes from there, and that's another place that things got into your head.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do here is let people know that this is not one dimensional. This is like 42 dimensional. Because when you listen to this from track to track, yeah, sure, the songwriting, the tone, the sound, but the breadth of what you've done here is both captivating and challenging.
Oh, nice one, man. Well, it's funny you mentioned The Darkness, because that's the first gig I ever saw.
I know. Was
The Darkness. And he came out on a White Tiger. Justin did Above the Crowd, and I was like, I want to do that for the rest of my life. It was like such a good gig.
When you get to a certain age, and you're me, you're obsessed with death. I always say, I want to live forever. Taxi in your head, death.
Yeah.
dark stuff. How do you think about all of this stuff?
I think it was like that song was written in the time where I'd first started like going out with my friends quite a lot, and we would like stay up a bit too late and stuff. And there, one of the lyrics, "Dancing on the Rooftop," that actually happened. It was my friend Wilf and Katrin. We were at a house party, and the sun was coming up, and we were like, "Let's go on the roof." And we like climbed up onto the roof, and we were dancing on the roof and stuff, and it was really fun. But yeah, it was like my first kind of like experiences of going out to like house parties and raves and stuff. And I wanted to just have a song that, I don't know, kind of like was the excitement. Like the lyrics basically follow the story of the night, like you kind of getting in a taxi and rolling the Rizzlers and all that, and then they kind of going into town. And yeah, that was definitely the kind of like most psychedelic-y sort of inspired track.
BBC One, you've got notice, it's great. Welcome to America. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So do you ever think about the business part of the business and say, it's not as easy?
No, yeah.
It's not as easy here. So do you think about that as an artist at all?
Yeah, it's a weird one because obviously they're not, the venue, then it's nice venues, but gonna be honest, it's like we haven't really had many people come in to see us because no one knows who we are over here, really. Like yourself, obviously there's a few people that do, but we're genuinely just really like surprised and happy to be here. And I've been in bands since I was like 14, and I know how hard it is to even get people to come to see you in like the city next to you, let alone flying over to the States and trying to do it. So as much as for us, I think it's about kind of like having, it would be amazing to crack America and all that stuff, and I respect bands that do it so much, I really do, but it's not really, we more have kind of like realistic ambitions. For us, it would be like, it'd be incredible to just have like, you know, if people out here were like into our records and come and see us, that'd be amazing. But we already feel like so lucky to have been asked to come here, and we're very grateful that like for everyone who's made that possible for us, and people like yourself for listening to us and everything. It's been amazing. This alone has been an amazing experience, and we just hope, we're coming to South By.
And I'll be there.
We just hope to build on it, really.
South By, first South By, huh?
Yeah.
Ask me.
Yeah,
then you know. Tell me about the book that Hangover Square is based on.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that book.
So it was initially a play, by a guy called Patrick Hamilton, and then I think it became a novel after. I might have got that wrong way around. But yeah, it was, it came to my attention because my dad is a Bernard Herrmann and Alfred Hitchcock obsessive. And growing up in the house, it was a bit surreal. We had like Bates Motel posters and Vertigo posters when we were kids, and we saw all of those films, my brother and sister and I, when we were probably too young to. But it was great because my dad was just exposing us to the music of Bernard Herrmann, basically. Like, he just loves the films and the music, and also Taxi Driver as well. But the film adaptation of the book, the film, my dad didn't say it was that good, but the music is amazing, and it's by Bernard Herrmann. And so that's how my dad got into the book. When I moved out, when I was like 18, my dad gave me the book, and he was like, this would be a good thing for you to read now. And I haven't really read all that many books, but out of the ones I have read, that's the one that really stuck with me the most. It's just like such a good story, and it's really dark, and yeah, I don't know. I think it's a really beautiful book, and it just, I don't know, it was one of those, it's one of the easiest sort of songs lyrically I've ever written, because I struggle with lyrics because we have the song like Face Behind a Cigarette. I'd rather leave out lyrics than put ones in that I wasn't like happy with. Do you know what I mean? Like having filler. So there's hardly any words in it, but it's me just being lazy, basically. But with Hangover Square, the song really wrote itself because the story was all there. So I was just trying to like capture the mood of George Harvey Bone and all the stuff he gets up to. And obviously there's little nods to murder in there and stuff. And have you read the book?
I haven't, but that's why I'm asking you to tell me, because I want to.
Yeah, do you mind if I give away? I don't want to give away too
much. Oh, you mean the spoiler?
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. I'm old. I'll forget by the time I read the book.
But it basically ends in like a murder, and I kind of wanted to have the the song end like it was almost like it was like catching on fire, like, so the song ends with this loop of like the lyrics go dead mood, and then it's got this like, the melody was definitely inspired by like some of the Bernard Herrmann stuff, because it's like this weird like whole tone scale thing. I don't really know much music theory, but I know the whole tone thing, and I wanted it to sound like that, and it's just this kind of like loop, and that's about it really. But I was really cool because my dad obviously gave me the book, and then when it came to recording it, we were like, it'd be great if he played the strings on it, because it would be like the circle or whatever, finishing the circle. So that was a really great experience. I'm really, for the second album, going to get my mum to play clarinet on. And
what is the filter for a Boy Azuga song?
It comes down to how kind of like, it's really hard to say this without sounding like pretentious or whatever, but it's kind of like, it kind of comes down to how much you believe in the song, or at least like how kind of honest and, or like how genuinely excited you are, and you're not overthinking or second guessing, like,
you can feel it.
Yeah, you can just, when it's right, you can just sort of feel it, and like you can gauge other people's reaction. Like I play stuff to all my friends, my girlfriend, my mum, my dad, everyone is like, I always play stuff to people because it's like, I have like a sort of close circle of people I would play to for, and send to, like a guy called Matthew Evans from the Keys, a band from Cardiff, he's one of my heroes, amazing songwriter, and I would always send him mixes because I know he'd give me a frank, honest feedback about it, and that sort of stuff is, they're like the unsung people, I think, in projects. It's like, for every great record or good record, there's a whole load of people that had to go like, that's great, but you should try this. And anyway, sorry, I've gone off on one. I think the filter would just be a mixture of like your gut feeling, and also people around you either saying, some people would be, there's an, on the flip side, you might have some people would be like, nah, that, and then you'll be like, actually, no.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside.
Yeah.
Think of them as the bread. And then songs by others in between.